Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2024. Today, stock valuation. This has a part of it. I'll do mostly the setup, the terms, definitions in this lecture, and then on Monday I'll do the math part. I had planned to have an Excel sheet up for you, but when I uploaded it, someone sent me right away that it was a mess, so I've deleted it, and I'll get it back up this weekend with some more of the math in it for you as a template for this stock valuation part of the course. And you will really, it'll be important for you to have that, because this can get a little hairy if you try to do it by hand. With Excel, it's a lot easier. Even though it still looks a little hard, it's a lot easier than if you had to do it manually. So stay tuned for that nice Excel sheet to supplement the other ones that you're getting along the way. Let me see. Unmute. We're going to have a look at the numbers here, see what's going on in the market. And we have another one of those odd days. It's a bull day. You see all the green? That's good. That's bull. But at the same time, no, this is exactly the opposite of what usually should happen on a bull or a bear day. The Dow should be up or down the least, because it's the lowest risk portfolio. It's up 0.70%. And then you've got the S&P 500 up less, up only a third of a percent. And then the NASDAQ, which should be the big gainer in a bull on a bull day, it's up only 0.07%. So it's in exactly the opposite order that it would typically we would expect it to be in. And the only explanation of that, well, there might be other things, but when you see something like this, it usually means that the market is responding to good news, bull day. But in this case, the good news is better the bigger the company. So on a day like this, you've got great news for the ginormous companies of the earth. It's good news for the 500 big companies. And it's not very much good news. It's kind of good news, but it really doesn't impact the small cap companies of the NASDAQ. So there you are, one of those kinds of days where the good news is very good news for the big dogs, but when you're a small dog, it's like, yeah, that's fine, but it's nothing to write home about. Now, going over here just quickly, crude, it's trying its best to get underneath that trading range from 81 to 87 or 88. And as you can see, early this morning, before the sun was up, it was actually below 81. It had broken back down through the neckline back toward its old trading range. But it recovered, as you can see, and it's just bouncing there, just barely above $81 per barrel on the light sweet Brent crude. So it wants to come back down. The most likely explanation that I'm hearing is there was an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Russia to restrict their oil output. Supply goes down, price goes up. That would cause the price to go up. Well, that's all well and good until the cheating starts. Russia sees that the price of oil has gone up. It's going to try to get more oil produced. Even the Saudis, they see the price of oil going up, they'll produce more. They'll violate the whole reason that the price was going up. It was because they were restricting their supply. But that call of that extra money for that high price on the oil induces them to start putting out more oil. And, of course, other countries, they'll increase their oil output because the price has gone up, so the quantity that they supply will go up too. And so that kind of keeps the oil price from going crazy upward because everyone sees a higher price, and that induces the quantity supplied from microeconomics to increase. So there you are. Gold has found its way through the neckline at $2,200 an ounce. Why it's in such happy, chipper mood, it's kind of hard to say. But you can also see that silver is on its way up too. Look how volatile. Jeez, silver is really volatile today. But I don't know that I would say this is gold and the gold bugs thinking that the financial apocalypse is coming, as much as it is some kind of a broader push upward in metals prices right now. What that's all about, I can't tell you, but one way or the other. Here, let me get out from the... Okay, now, got it. Now, the 10-year bond. Yay, yield going back down again. Back down, we've lost 4.2 basis points on the yield, right, so far today. Lower interest rates overall. So that's good news. The yield's going down. That means that the price of bonds is going up, and that means that there is buying into the bond market. Now, interestingly, there's obviously buying going on in equities and also in debt as well. So that kind of says there's investors pulling their money out of their pockets. They're throwing some of that capital at the stocks, and they're throwing some at bonds too. Now, that's a healthy sign. So in other words, seeing that downstroke, that's a bull market in bonds because the price is going in the opposite direction of what you see here, which is the yield. Moving along. Well, hell. Nikkei, it was going up all day. It was in a really good mood. That was in the night last night here. But then near the end, it started. There was a sell-off started. And then the bell rang over there in Tokyo, and that stopped the bears from the run that they were making. But you can see there at the end, the bears were trying to take over there. And, of course, come over when the sun set in Tokyo. Eventually it rose in London, and as you can see, that bearish sentiment came on hard over there in London. And dropped, then it stayed the same, and then there was another bear run. But there at the end, the bulls kind of came in. And one way that you could explain it is that this was bargain hunters. When prices of stocks go down that much, a lot of times you'll see investors looking around saying, all right, let's find stocks that got drawn down in the bear run, and see, well, those are probably shouldn't have gone down as much as they did, and they start buying up the bargains down here, and that causes the price overall of the FTSE 100 to start to come back up a little bit. Bargain hunting is an old tradition, finding things that got dragged down when the tide went out and getting those and pulling them back in. But that's about all there is to say about that right now. Okay, all of that off the table here. This, like as I said, this first of the two lectures is more of the terminology, the definitions, and the background. And that sets us up so that I can attack the math on Monday, and by then have some Excel sheets that will help, one Excel sheet that will help do a lot of that, of the more difficult conceptually, the more difficult math. But to start off with, this is about stocks. The fancy word for stocks is equity. You wouldn't say, sir, well, I invest in stocks. You'd say, I'm long in equities. Okay, that makes you sound better when you go to the finance singles bar, okay? And we all go there, right? Okay. Now, stocks. When we say stock, we usually are referring to one kind of stock, common stock, and we are also referring to one kind of common stock. We're not thinking about all of the nuances, which actually can be kind of important if you're an investor. Well, okay, I see a price quote. Okay, that's obviously going to be common stock. If it has one, two, or three, or four letter trading symbol, that's probably common stock. And so you don't think much past that. But actually, there are different kinds of common stock, and you'd have to know which one you're grabbing. So for example, if I'm not mistaken, and I may be wrong about this, I was looking at the financial statements of different companies a while back, and I saw this one. In the balance sheet, there's this place where it says common stock at par, additional paid in capital, that whole thing. And it all tells you how many shares are outstanding of the common stock. And on that one line, it actually was like four lines, they were listing different kinds of common stock. And I had no idea. I think it was Netflix, that there was more than one kind of common stock. And I did not know that. So I thought, well, which one am I buying here if there are different ones? Well, fortunately, there are ways that you can find that out by looking beyond just the trading symbol sometimes. But behind it, this is kind of a historical note, and it doesn't actually start with finance. It starts with physics. And I'll bring up a rather famous gentleman in physics, which is where we get all of our equations, really, in finance. His name was Albert Einstein. Now, everyone thinks Einstein, the theory of relativity. Well, actually, there were two theories. There was a special theory and then the general theory. But Einstein did not become famous because of the theory of relativity. It was a much more common kind of thing that he investigated. It had been known for a couple of centuries. There was a physics phenomenon. And there'd been attempts to kind of like explain it. What's going on here? It's called Brownian motion. You see, if this gentleman is a point on a surface like water, and he's a little speck on that surface, and I got tiny, tiny little specks around him, the specks won't stay in one place. If you watch them carefully, they'll move. They'll be buzzing all around. It's a very slow process in a fairly solid thing like water. But in this room, Brownian motion is everywhere, constantly. These atoms and molecules just bouncing all over the place. Your oxygen molecules, your nitrogen, your carbon dioxide, even your fart molecules are just bouncing all over the place. That's Brownian motion. The question is, well, first of all, what is it? Why does it happen? And what does this mean? Well, Brownian motion has this tendency to bring all of those random movements back to the center. They'll just keep finding their way back and then go on their way. Boing, 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 like that. Okay, that's kind of an odd thing. Why does that happen? Is there a mathematics of it, equations? Well, the answer was eventually, yes, there is. There's an explanation for it. It's energy in the system bouncing things around, just like in the air. And yes, it does tend to find its way over and over again back to the center. The fancy term for that is mean reverting or average reverting. Where it started? Well, it also happens in things that are in motion. You're walking in a forest, and you're taking random walks this way. Ah, a bird over there. Ah, some weed. You bouncing around. But you will probably always be coming back, at least briefly, to the center line. mean reverting. Take that to one more level. In some physical processes, even though there is a mean, it either stays straight, it goes down, or it goes up. Stocks are like that. They don't stay at the same price level forever. They tend to bounce upward and downward, but they have a bias. And in physics, you don't have to know this, but in physics, broader mathematics, I should say, we call them martingale processes. There's a plain old generic martingale that goes straight, never goes, doesn't bias one way or the other. But then there are some martingales that have a tendency to go downward. They bounce around, but there's always a downward track. Tendency. We call those super martingales, and then oddly enough, the ones that track upward are called sub martingales. Here's the point though. Stocks are sub martingales. The prices are sub martingales. Not the returns, but the prices, because they have a tendency upward, but they also are subject to Brownian motion. They tend to bounce around. That is exactly what happens with stocks. There's some martingales. They exhibit that bias upward in price over long periods of time, but they also bounce around it. They bounce around that central tendency upward. That means this is, in our world, they have different words in different sciences. That is the intrinsic value, where the center line of the rise is. And then all of this bouncing around it is the market price at any given moment. The market price is the Brownian motion, just like in any other, just like in this room, just like in that little bit of water. We have the same thing. It's just physics. Yes, stock prices overall tend upward over time. There is a tendency to that. And I'll mention that in just a minute, something about that. But at almost no time would you see it at the intrinsic value itself. At any given time, it's either going to be overvalued or undervalued relative to the intrinsic value at that moment. Now, a little word about that upward bias. Do we have an idea of what it is? Over a very long period of time, we actually have an equation. We know from theory how steep that line is. In your grandparents, and to some extent in the early part of your parents' lives, that was around 7 to 8%. In other words, over a long period of time, in a well-diversified portfolio, we could anticipate maybe 8% return, the intrinsic value line. And there's some debate, but we now know that that line for you has actually flattened some. It's more like about 5 to 6%, if I remember right. It all hinges on a parameter, one of the universal parameters, like the speed of light, the natural constant, Avogadro's number. Well, we have one for finance too. It's called Tobin's Q. And Tobin's Q has slid. We are not sure why, but you guys will not naturally realize the same long haul intrinsic growth that your grandparents would have, or your parents in their earlier years would have. It has slid some. And that isn't good news for you, because it means that your wealth accumulation, even being very responsible investors, probably won't be quite as good as it would have been if you had been like lived in the 70s and 80s and even the 90s in your productive years, in your career income earning years. Okay, that's all backdrop. And is there some reason? Oh, there's an eraser. And it just gives you kind of the idea that what we're doing here in this part of the course especially is we are doing a field-specific or a discipline-specific application of much larger processes in the universe. Now, getting practical again here. Two broad types of stock. Common stock and preferred stock. Now, I will lay off preferred stock probably until Monday. Common stock takes enough time to talk about on its own. Now, first things first, and I brought this one up before, but I'll bring it up again here. Stock trading. Decades and decades ago, in the 1920s and before that, was a wild west. It was unregulated. It was just a freewheeling game of dishonesty, lies, cheating, scams, and gamesmanship. And being honest was probably not a very good idea in that time. And this was under the philosophy, the old neoclassical philosophy, free markets are the best markets. A good government is the government that's small enough you can drown it in a bathtub. The French term laissez-faire, allow them to do as they whatever they want, was in play. And it just got toxic in the 1920s. And the markets were just a wild west, a maniacal place. And as happens surprisingly often in history, and quite quickly in this case, on a Black Monday in 1929, the stock market buckled, just crashed and burned. Nothing of that order ever since then. All because it was just unregulated, uncontrolled. And when you have uncontrolled, you have all the features that will destroy a system eventually. And then we had the Great Depression started, and that was fueled to some extent by very stupid measures in Congress to stop imports, which caused a nightmare in global trade. We stopped imports from other countries, then they stopped imports from ours in retaliation, and we all went to hell just on that one. Well, in 1932, the first major election after the crash and the beginning of the Great Depression, the voters kicked the rascals out. They kicked out every one of those sons of bitches who had been preaching the gospel of free markets. Brought in a very powerful president and a completely new, much more progressive Senate and House of Representatives. And so began the era of reform. And it was in all kinds of areas. Reform of labor laws, reform of banking, reform of stock securities markets. In securities markets, we started this new Congress with the new president with the Securities Act of 1933, which cracked down on the primary market. In other words, the issuing by companies of stocks and things like that. It also created the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, which would have the power to enforce the securities law. The SEC, like all agencies, is granted by legislation. It is enabled. And then its job is to interpret the law and enforce and let everyone know this is how it's going to go, and then enforce that law. Now, the SEC operates on civil law. You do something wrong, the SEC comes in and smacks you with fines and other sanctions. If it is a seriously bad offense, the SEC will turn it over to the Department of Justice for criminal prosecution. And then it gets to the point where it's not just fines, but it could also be prison terms as well. So that was important. And actually, one of the nastiest things is that the SEC could hit a company with civil fines and take them to court and get civil fines, and then the DOJ, the Department of Justice, could come in and try them again on criminal charges. And a lot of companies screamed for many, many years, that's double jeopardy. Supreme Court established, no, it's not. These are different. The jeopardies are different. The jeopardy in one is just money. The jeopardy in the other one could be as much as imprisonment or actually taking a corporation and ending it. So that was the Securities Act of 1933, but they weren't done. Congress passed and the president signed the Securities Exchange Act. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which cracked down and regulated, which caused the regulation of the secondary markets, the buying and selling of stocks by investors, brokerage houses, all that kind of stuff. And to this day, the SEC watches over all of this. Sometimes it is a much tougher regulator, and sometimes it's a very weak regulator. I've lived through several cycles of each one. And in my time, when I was heavily involved as a consultant, they were kind of like on the fence between really tough and really weak. Ultimately, there has come a self-policing organization that is sanctioned by the SEC. It's called FINRA, F-I-N-R-A. FINRA does the running to catch the bad guys, especially in secondary markets, the brokerage house and all that. The big criticism of FINRA is that it almost always kicks the asses of the little players. And very, very rarely will it try to make a move on the heavies. Once in a while, it'll get a whale just to show that it's tough. But for the most part, the big dogs get by with the financial equivalent of murder. That's just the reality of it. You got insider trading by Senator Loeffler and her husband, who is the chairman and owner of the New York Stock Exchange. You've got no apparent action against Elon Musk and his brother for their trading. You've got no action against Pelosi for some of her, what appears to be insider trading. They don't go after those kinds of giants. They go after the little people, the brokers, some retail trader at some house or some company that's done something naughty as far as selling securities and all that. Just the reality of it. Welcome to the world. But here's the thing. I'm going to get to common stock. But all of this impacts these laws and the regulation, impacts these words, common and preferred stock. So know that. First things first, a company cannot sell common stock unless the stock is registered with the SEC and with any state in whose citizens would have offers or put to them. There are a couple of exemptions, and I'll talk about those in a minute. But realistically, if you wanted to do an IPO, sir, you would make out one of, follow the rules of the Securities Exchange, the Securities Act of 1933. It's a primary offering. So you would have to follow the rules of how to do that. And the rules are set up for these different forms. The big classic form to register common stock, to sell it to the public, would be called Form S1. And then there are some other ones. There's an SB1 and an SB2. They're sort of like for smaller offerings. But the classic form S1 is something to behold. Before it became illegal for someone, a consultant like me, to do it, I did one form S1. It was, this was back before most people had computers, but that's why I could do it, because I had a computer back in that time. And it was something to behold, though, even then. Put together all of the requirements, all of these different sections and the reporting and the disclosures and all that, get the audited financial statements and all that. It was a nightmare. And then I submitted it in triplicate on paper, which was what we did back then, and just waited. After a while, I think it was a couple of weeks, my fax machine started. And it didn't stop. It just kept printing. These were the deficiencies the SEC had found in my filing. It was over 400, something like 437 deficiencies. Well, I thought about just, you know, dropping everything and joining a hippie club or something. It was bad. I was freaking out. Called an old consultant who'd helped me in the past, and I just started blubbering, and he said, how many were there? And I think I said 437. He said, really? Well, that's not too bad. God, turned out that most of them were just formatting errors or something in the wrong place. I had spent days fixing those, and I submitted again, revised, S1/A, amended, and days later, a couple of weeks later, out came the fax machine, turned on again, and I thought, oh God, here it comes. This time, 6 deficiencies, which was amazing to me. And all but one of them was just formatting errors that I'd missed. Okay, so got it finally, and now here's what happens. The SEC, if you've done everything right, and this goes to the point of how government agencies work. You never get anything by a government entity approved. There's no such thing as approval. The term in government is qualified. The SEC qualified the offering. In other words, it meets our requirements. That doesn't say that they're endorsing it or approving of it or anything like that. It just says you may now proceed. And how do you proceed? You proceed to the quiet period. You shut up about the offering. You don't brag about it. You don't advertise it. You are just sitting there waiting for the date that the SEC says you go live. Now, the SEC, the Form S-1, is a monster document. It has 3 parts to it. Now, this first part is like boilerplate. It's just this, that, and the other thing, name of the company, where you're located, blah, blah, blah. Just pages of disclosures like that. The last part is the audited financial statements. In here in the middle is the big part, the prospectus, the selling document. It's what is given to the investors, and to potential investors, I should say. Now, during the quiet period, you can have what's called a red herring. It's the prospectus, but there are all these places where it's in red, the lettering is. to warn that this is just preliminary. We're not live yet. You can't buy because you've read this prospectus. It's just there. And you can kind of show that to some interested parties. But it's the red herring becomes is taken off on the day that the offering goes live. And then you can offer and sell the stock. But only in the states where you have gotten qualified. So in other words, when you get that federal qualification, that does not mean that you can go out and sell to anyone in a state where you have not gotten the Division of Securities of that state to say it's okay as well. And that's a problem too. I might have an offering and I have gotten it qualified by the SEC, it's lit, and I got the parallel qualification here in Illinois. But I didn't know it, but I'm a broker and I'm trying to sell that to someone at a dinner, and I didn't realize that person is a citizen of, let's say, Missouri. And all of a sudden, I am in a problem because I did not register it in Missouri. You got to understand that you're going to pay for every, you've got to pay each state for them to review it. And so that can be a problem if you don't make sure that you've got all the states in which you would actually approach citizens for the offering. Okay, that is how it happens. But there's one more step. It's and some of this will spill over when I start talking about common stock and all that. But there's another issue too. What was I thinking? Good God. The offer and sale of the stock. There's that quiet period. You can actually, a few things can be changed during the quiet period. Like suppose that you set the price of the stock. The selling price on the IPO will be $12 a share. However, suppose the market has a surge during the quiet period. You could make a quick amendment to change and fix the final price along the way, right before the offering starts even. So there's that part too. But it's live now, but you still need a trading symbol. The SEC has nothing to do with trading symbols. You need a market for this. That means that you have to go almost de novo, all new, to the NASD or to the NYSE or something like that, or to a regional exchange like the Philly. Philly X, you have to get a trading symbol. That's a completely different thing. So I did that, and it was all NASDAQ stuff. Even the Form S-1 was the NASDAQ, NASD. And you have to file a form with them called the 15C211. Don't worry, you don't need to know that. But you're through it again. And their reviewers are bitching at you. And I found out very quickly that they can be tougher than the SEC can be. They're going to look at the same documents, and they might find something that the SEC didn't care about, and they're going to bitch their heads off. They'll just say, no, you're going to amend this, and you're going to send it back to us before we even talk about giving you a trading symbol. I mean, the trading symbol is kind of important because that's how people will order the stock and sell the stock. So that's a part of it, too. This gives you an idea of what's going on behind the scenes. I don't want to beat it over the head, but most people have no clue. Even investors, I just buy and sell stocks. I don't need to know this. Well, it kind of helps to know it. Now, I mentioned exemptions, and this begins to move us back toward the center of this lecture. There are a couple of ways that you can sell stock without going through a registration. However, that stock is generally restricted. Now, let me get into it a little bit deeper. I'm a company, I want to raise $5 million. If I can find what are called sophisticated investors who do not need to have their hand held. They're not stupid. They are very well informed, as well as being wealthy. I can sell stock to them. I don't need a trading symbol. I don't need a registration statement. I can just sell it to them. But I have, if the SEC or some division of securities comes to me and says, let's talk about your investors, I can show them that, yeah, this was a sophisticated investor. She had her act together. She knew what she was doing and all that good stuff. Or possibly to you, because you were under advisement for her, so she can bundle you under her. But that stock is not freely tradable. That stock is restricted. And literally, when we used to have stock certificates, a restricted stock would have a big red stamp on it, restricted. So the stock transfer agent was not allowed to take that stock certificate, tear it up, and issue a new one to someone you sold it to. So in other words, if you are a restricted shareholder, an insider, as it were, you're not allowed to just freely trade your stock, even if there's a trading symbol. This all falls under what's called Rule 144A. Now, you'll hear me call it Rule 144. It's technically, I guess, Rule 144A. But, so you don't have freely tradable status. Your stock, you might have a pile of stock. You might be a millionaire on paper, but you can't sell it. Now you're saying, wait a minute, fat boy, I've heard about it. Jeff Bezos just sold a couple billion dollars worth of his stock. True enough. You see, Rule 144A sets up windows in which you can, an insider can unrestrict stock. And those windows have to do with time and with timing. There are certain, you know, spaces during a year when some of that stock could be sold. And there are also times when you cannot. The timing. Like you couldn't... the CEO could not sell any of his stock 2 days before earnings were released because he might be dumping his stock knowing that they were going to have bad earnings, and so he's getting out while the getting out is good. So and all of this has to happen. You can get stock, that restricted label, taken off it, but only by opinion, with an opinion of legal counsel. In other words, the stock transfer agent will not move a restricted share to an unrestricted share unless he or she has a letter from the legal counsel saying this is can be done under Rule 144A because of. So in other words, you can get out from under a restriction, but only for a while, only under certain conditions. In other cases, there's another way that you can get out from under restrictions. And this is a bad thing for normal investors. You see, a lot of companies start out with private placements. That's what these are called. But then the company goes public and there's all this freely tradable stock out there. There are quite a few times when when a company wants to sell stock to the public, it will bundle its restricted investors into that offering. So you might see an offering for 10 million shares, and if you look underneath it, wait a minute, they're also registering a million shares of investors' private placement stock so that it becomes freely tradable as well. So you might be surprised that you think a certain amount of stock is going to be released to the public, and it's more than that. That's actually going to flow out there, because some of the old restricted investors who started it, they're going to get their stock registered, and then they can just trade it like any old stock because it is fully registered by the SEC under the qualification of the form. So, first things first, common stock. there is in this the normal common stock, but then there could also be, the book uses the term founder stock. That's kind of a little bit of a misnomer, because they don't necessarily have to be founders. But for example, when I did consulting work, there were several cases where I would form a corporation, get it ready for an IPO, and they say, well, we can't pay you very much. And I say, I'm going to take some founder stock along with you guys. You guys started the company, you're going to get founder stock, so am I. So founder stock does exist. It's restricted stock. No question about it. It's restricted stock under Rule 144. But then there is the normal, for lack of a better word, the normal kind of common stock. But there you have to be careful too, because a company could have several classes of normal stock, of common stock. You see, the board of directors is the agent of the shareholders. They represent the shareholders, not individually, but as a body. So every year the board of directors gets elected. Now I'm going to do a simple one here. You'll have four positions: president, vice president, treasurer, and secretary. You own one share of common stock of this corporation. That means that you will get one vote for each of these positions. One vote. And you'll get it in the mail. Well, cast your vote. You can go to the annual shareholders meeting and cast your vote. There's some companies, and it has to do with how it's set up in the charter. Let's say that you have your one share. So you get to vote for this position: president, vice president, treasurer, secretary. But you look at this scoundrel and you say, I don't want him. So you could actually concentrate your four individual votes as one on his opponent in the election. You can do that with some companies. No, I'm not going to vote 1111. I'm going to vote 0004 against him, for someone who's competing with him for the position. That's not in all companies, but it is out there in some companies. But the rule is one vote per share for each board of directors position. This is when we get into the classes of common stock. You can have one class of common stock, or you can have more than one, maybe a second one. Class A, Class B. Class A gets one vote per share. Class B, 10, 100. It's called super voting rights. That's the biggest thing about it. This way, insiders can get enough voting power that the outsiders, even if they all hated the board of directors, they can't do anything about them, because the Class A has such great power. And I'll show you one right here. And I've probably shown you this one before, but I'll show it to you again now. I did this early in the semester, I believe. Is there some reason why I can't get this computer to do anything? My favorite example is Berkshire Hathaway. This BRK-B are called the baby Berks. They are just plain old common stock. $414.67 per share. Nice stock. And you can get to say, I am an owner of Warren Buffett's company. Yeah, Warren and I are in kind of a lot the same. We both have an equity stake, an ownership stake in Berkshire Hathaway. But that's a baby Berk, a BRK-B. Let's look at the big Berk, BRK-A. Those are the insider shares, the super voting shares. Right now, one of those shares is $627,265. That's one share. So you might want to look for some change under the seat of your sofa at home and see if you got enough to grab one of these. These put you in the big league. You would get to be in the same room with Warren Buffett at the annual shareholders meeting, probably. I mean, you would get to say, I breathe the same air as Warren Buffett. I breathe the same farts that he emitted, whatever you want. You're a big dog. And that's an awfully steep price. Can you imagine a round lot of those? It'd be about $62.7 million. Nah. But that gives you an idea of how valuable that vote is. You got that super voting rights, that means you have something of great value. And that's why that price is so high. Notice, by the way, that this neither the baby Berks nor the big Berks pay a dividend. You'd say, well, that kind of sucks. Well, not really. If you've got the money to be investing in Berkshire Hathaway, you're not waiting for your dividend check in the mail so you can buy dinner at Denny's. That dividends don't mean anything at that level. So it's definitely, notice that the beta, slightly below one, somewhat, so it's a relatively safe stock. PE ratio is pointing out that it's probably a little undervalued. So, I mean, you can't go wrong if you grab a couple of shares of Berkshire Hathaway A. You'll probably do well with them. Oh, looky. The Berkshire A's are up $4,215 today. So there's some bragging. Of course, that's as a percentage, which is all that matters. That's just about 0.75% for the day because of the price being so enormous. Okay, enough of that. But there is where you get into more than one class. Now, this is a lot of times you'll see classes of stock. For companies where there was an original family, and they give the founder's shares are these Class A shares so that they won't lose control of the company through buying and selling of the stock in the open market. The family has super voting rights so that they can keep it in the family generation after generation after generation. If I'm not mistaken, Ford is an example of that. There are a couple of others. Hewlett-Packard was, but it didn't keep them from getting the family from getting kicked out. But I swear, I think it was, I don't want to take the time to do it. I think I saw it was Netflix that had several different classes of common stock. Oddest thing. Who would have known? Okay, enough of that one. Now, let me go on here. So there's common stock. That's that stuff that, yeah, go ahead.